From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. If we're honest with ourselves, a lot of us believe that being an adult was better or somehow different in the good old days. We gripe about a generation of young people who can't seem to grow up. We scoff at the grown-ups who can't seem to act their age. And the image we have in our mind is the 50s or some gauzy time when people had stable marriages and stayed with one company in one neighborhood. Well, in his new book, the historian Stephen Mintz bursts the bubble. Mintz has written a history of adulthood, and in it, he says that transition from adolescence has actually never been easy or predictable or stable, for that matter. Today in the program, Mintz is joining us to talk about his book, which gives an historical perspective to that struggle to come of age. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There hasn't really ever been a history written about being an adult. Until now, until Stephen Mintz. And it makes sense because adulthood seems like such a broad subject. And what do we mean by adulthood? How do we define it beyond, you know, our age? Mintz has written histories about other parts of human development, the history of the American family, for example. And you may remember his book Huck's Raft about the history of childhood. But adulthood, that's another subject altogether. Today in the program, he's joining us to talk about his new book. It's called The Prime of Life. In it, he gives some historical perspective to this moment in time when he says adulthood is going through extraordinary change. Stephen Mintz is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the executive director of the University of Texas Systems Institute for Transformational Learning. And he's joining us today from the studios of radio station KPFT in Houston. And Stephen Mintz, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
I wanted to begin with that that tidbit I mentioned right at the beginning, and you point out in the book that adulthood is that one stage of life that really doesn't have a history written about it. Why do you figure that is?
Well, no one today says life begins at 40, except in irony.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? When asked, most Americans say that their life peaked at the age of 26,
wow,
meaning that the next 5, 6, 7 decades of life are the mere afterclimax. And I think we need to understand, how did adulthood come to be devalued? How did it come to be seen as a period of decline? How is it then that we encourage young people to grow up if we all agree that adulthood is a time of stress and stagnation, anything but a time of liveliness and fulfillment? And yet neither you nor I nor anyone I know would in fact trade their life today for what they were like at 16, 18, or 21, except for the energy.
Is that a new phenomenon? I mean, we'll obviously get into the details because you write about this. Is this a new phenomenon that we now have come to? I mean, you talk about in literature, for example, you know, the whole Walter Mitty concept that once you reach adulthood, middle age, your life becomes stagnant and meaningless and boring, and you give up all of those, you know, elements of being reckless and fun. Is that a new concept in relative terms?
I would argue that it is.
Yeah.
That is, that there used to be at least a counter argument that adulthood was better than being an adolescent or someone in their 20s. Think of Cary Grant or Katharine Hepburn. And that was an image of adulthood associated with sophistication and worldliness that seemed well beyond the wet behind the ears of the teens and 20s. And there was an adult culture that has faded away and been replaced by television, for better or worse. And so we've created a world where not only does adolescence or post-adolescence seem superior, but there doesn't seem to be a real alternative to it.
I wanted to ask you about why you think this history is important, because you say in the book you believe that by exploring the history of all of this, that people can, and here's how you put it in the book, broaden the range of possibilities. So I guess what you're seeing is adults looking at their lives in adulthood as kind of meaningless, and you're saying, look, if you look at this historically, you can actually see your life as something joyful or wise or interesting.
There is a common theme in our culture, which is that everything is going to hell in a handbasket.
Right.
And we can apply it to almost every facet of life. The family is breaking down. Children are becoming increasingly disrespectful. Adult lives are increasingly meaningless. It's easy, I think in that way, that the story of history is a story of decline and fall. But my own research suggests that that's not the right way to look at things. For example, I wrote on the history of the family, and families have always been changing. The changes have always been anxiety-inducing, but families survived nonetheless. Our children are growing up very differently than the children who grew up in the 1950s and 1960s, and I do think in some ways it is worse.
Yeah.
That is, kids have less free time outside, less unsupervised time, less physical freedom than they had. But the only way to understand that is historically, right? To understand that things changed, and they changed for a reason, and most important of all, they're going to change again in the future.
Right. These myths are an important, I think, part of the book in terms of you sort of breaking them down. One of them is this idea, this impression again, that in another time, in some golden age, this transition to adulthood was smooth and easy and life was more stable and life was more predictable. But you say in the book early on, coming of age has never been easy. We've always struggled for the most part with this transition.
Exactly. The transition to adulthood is the great drama of human life. And novelists and movie makers have known this for a long time, novelists since the 18th century and movie makers throughout the 20th and now into the 21st century. Because finding one's own identity, charting independence from parents while maintaining ties with parents, choosing a vocation, developing a sustaining and sustainable relationship with another person, rearing children. I mean, this period is the most monumental, most dramatic moment in people's lives. What's interesting to me, though, is that the 20s have become the decisive decade when lives can go the right way or they can go the wrong way. We've controlled adolescence more. We've put in guardrails to protect adolescents. And so the time of life when life can go off the tracks is now the 20s. And so it's absolutely pivotal that parents play a crucial role with their children in their 20s. No longer does parenthood end with graduation. It goes on, and the key definer of whether kids will be successful is their parents' involvement and their ability to support them in their 20s.
So this idea, though, that that you have to figure this out in your 20s, is that built around a kind of a false premise, a misperception of history, because you write a lot about – I mean, Henry David Thoreau comes to mind, for example. A lot of people equivocating, changing their minds, changing their career path. That's a part of history. We've always done that. We've never settled in, it seems, in our history, in our 20s. It's always been the case, or very often been the case, that we equivocated a lot in our lives in that stage.
Absolutely, but there is a historical anomaly. That is, during the 1950s and early 1960s, people entered what we call adult status at a very early age. In as recently as 1970, not so long ago, as recently as 1970, half of American women were already married by the age of 21. And their husbands would have been about 2 years older than them. And they would have had 3 children, on average, by the age of 25. And most men expected to hold one career with one company for their entire lives. Now, that was a historical exception, but we see it every day in reruns of sitcoms,
yeah.
And it's become to us the norm.
That's
what
the standard.
We expect. Yeah. Right. We expect life to be like. And therefore, we feel, as you noted, mistakenly, that that's what life should be and really always has been.
Seems like a lot of this comes down to, I was trying to sort of synthesize, because there's a lot of information here. I was trying to synthesize what the what it's really about. And in many ways, it seems like it's what we think about our lives, the meaning of our lives. Because you say in the book that in the modern era, there was this profound shift about how people came to see the meaning of life. Do you think that's what it boils down to in many ways? Because, you know, we'll get to the idea of midlife angst, yeah, and all of those kinds of things. But do you think this is a core idea, how we evaluate the meaning of our lives?
Oh, absolutely. The rule book governing adulthood has gone through a revolution.
Yeah.
And it's gone through a revolution in your life, your listeners' lives, and my life. That is, there were certain expectations, fantasies that were widely held that have now broken down. Now, this isn't the first time that that has happened. It was about, roughly, 400 years ago that a decisive shift took place in where people found the meaning of life. They didn't find it in honor. They didn't find it in politics. They didn't find it in war. They found it in private life. They found it in marriage. They found it in rearing children. And they found it in the realm of work. And that's the world we've inherited. And in each of those areas, it's become tougher. Marriages have become more difficult to sustain. And parenting is surrounded with anxiety, and work has become much more demanding in our lifetimes. The 24/7 world is all about us. It's funny to me. Physically, our lives are less demanding than those who've come before us. Yet, psychologically, our lives are much more troubled. We experience, I am convinced, far more stress and far more pressure in our lives than did any previous generation. Now, they were physically worn out. Their lifespans were shorter. Their diet was poorer than ours. But we have certain kinds of stresses that they did not have. We have work-family tensions that they didn't have. We have relationship tensions that they didn't have. We worry incessantly about our children's future in a way they did not worry. And that makes our lives as difficult as any in the past.
All of your books so far have had this personal dimension, personal motivation to them. You were chronicling these changes in human history while you were going through these experiences yourself. And I'm guessing, because you point this out in the book, that the same can be said for this one. You explain... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yes. No, all of us, I think, have discovered that the predictability, the orderly nature that we expected our lives to follow is an extreme rarity, one that few of us will ever see. For those who marry, close to 50% will experience divorce, and not because they weren't committed, not because they didn't work at it, but we live in a world where there is a real tension between the demands and obligations of family life and the pressures of individuality. This is just part of the world we live in. We live in a society where kids, you know, they're not so easy to raise, and they don't always turn out the way that you'd wish, and you have to keep at it long after you thought you'd have to. And that's part of the world we live in. So we have certain fantasies about what adulthood would be like, and then discover it's not what it's really about. It can be a source of maturation. It can make us more empathetic. It can build our capacity to carry responsibilities. But it's not easy, and it's not for quitters.
Right. You say, I'm not sure how much you want to talk about this, but the personal aspect of it. You explain in the book that in the middle of your life's journey, you found yourself in a dark wood. Can you explain what that means?
Absolutely. Let me give three dimensions of that. First of all, a marriage that I thought would last for the rest of my life didn't. Yeah. And it was, for me, traumatic. Not trauma like battlefield trauma, not trauma like cancer, but trauma nonetheless. And you develop an image of yourself as a parent, and then your kids grow up, and they go on with their own lives, and you're reduced to the role of spectator, and that's not so easy either. And then in the job field, where I've had a lot of success, but one of the problems with success is that you're pressured to move on and move up.
Yeah.
And you get new responsibilities, whether you like them or not. And it means you have to work with new groups of people, and it means that you're in a more stressful workplace environment. You may make more money, but you, in a sense, earn it. And all of those issues begged me to try to come up with some historical perspective. Let me give one example, friendship. All of us know what friendship in its ideal form would be. We'd go out for coffee every day for 40 years with those who were close to, and we'd share stories, and we'd disclose our deepest feelings. But we all move so much. The average American will have 11 jobs in 3 different career fields, and will move repeatedly during their life. How then can we sustain intimate, close friendships with the people who mean the world to us? And is Facebook the best we can do?
Yeah.
These are questions that beg, I think, historical perspective.
I want to come back to this idea of friendship, because you go through in the book some of the basic features of adulthood and this idea of achieving intimacy, this idea of friendship, this idea of love. You put those in historical perspective. I want to come back to that after we get back from a break. Let me just sort of close out this part, though, that personal dimension from you, by asking sort of the takeaway that you got from this particular book? Because what you say is that the important lesson you've learned, it seems, is that adulthood is not about maturity or independence or success necessarily. It's about, and here's how you put it, coping with life's vicissitudes and being strengthened by them. Is that sort of the takeaway that you got from the book in general?
Absolutely. It may sound a little bit like a cliche, but I think it is the single truth that I pull away from this experience, that adulthood carries many more responsibilities than any other stage of life. We're not just responsible for ourselves, but we're responsible for our entire family and its well-being. And to carry those responsibilities in a proper manner requires a great deal of self-confidence and maturity and insight and empathy and understanding. It is not easy. And it's not surprising that many adults feel high levels of depression in their lives. It's extraordinary how many adults drink heavy amounts of alcohol. 1/3 of adults describe themselves as heavy drinkers or take sedatives or other prescription drugs to deal with stress. Again, we're talking about 1/3 of adults. Adulthood is not easy, but it is. I mean, we gain responsibilities and hopefully we grow so we have the strength to carry them.
Professor Stephen Mintz is with us. His new book is called The Prime of Life, A History of Modern Adulthood. You can join us if you like, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the scholar Stephen Mintz, talking about his latest book. He's done a number of histories about human development. His book, Huck's Raft, is a history of childhood, for example. But this latest is a history of modern adulthood. That's the subtext to the book. The Prime of Life is the title. One of the themes in the book is the fact that the meaning of adulthood, Professor Mintz, has shifted over time. Where did the word actually come from? Because you mentioned it's not really that old, at least in terms of the concept.
Right. It's only a little over 100 years old. It was, of course, meant originally as the opposite of childhood. So if a child was innocent, an adult was knowing. If a child was immature, then an adult was mature. In other words, we were trying to create a scientific understanding of the life course. And the problem with a scientific understanding of the life course is that, in my view, circumstances affect people much more than fixed biology or psychology. If we grow up in a war or we grow up in a depression, our mentality, our outlook, our everyday experiences are fundamentally different, and our path through adulthood will be different. And one thing I think many parents are worried about is if they had children who were in their teens or 20s during our Great Recession, we worry very much about what their future life trajectory will be, because we do know that in the past, kids who grew up in recessions fare less well than kids who come of age during a boom period.
Here's a question from Ben. He writes, I wonder if the process and history of growing into adulthood has changed as dramatically in rural locales as it has in urban ones. Ben writes, in my observation, kids who grow up in the country are more adult at a younger age than their city-bound peers. And I think it's because they're given more and more significant responsibilities at a younger age. Is that a dimension you've looked into?
I would completely agree with that view. Over-parenting, of which I am a guilty party, is not good for children developing independence. Children achieve independence. They forge an identity by being given responsibilities. And there's no question that in many rural areas, kids acquire responsibilities much younger than they do in more affluent urban areas. There's an interesting fact that anthropological literature has uncovered. Americans tend to give their kids chores too late. They wait to their 9, 10, and 11 before they give them chores, and then they promise an allowance as a reward. But in other societies, they give kids chores at the age of 2 or 3. And the kids are not all that competent at those chores, but they want to do the chores. If you give them responsibilities when they're very young, they continue to do them without much resistance. If you start late, it turns out not to work so well.
There's this idea that that this upcoming generation, and I guess, as you say, that's that heck in the handbasket sort of concept that, yep, that we all subscribe to. But there's this idea that this upcoming generation, you know, is shiftless, selfish, hangs around in their parents' basement playing video games or whatever the image might be. You write about how in Italy and Japan they really worry a lot about this. But you all say in every post-industrial society, you know, when kids come and move back in with their folks, people freak out. So this is not really new. So put this in historical perspective with us, because you write about in the 17th and 18th centuries, for example, young people went through this really long transitional stage from, you know, leaving home or certainly moving from that adolescent, post-adolescent period into adulthood.
In the more distant past, in general, a man could not marry until his father died. Yeah. That is, you had to wait till you got an inheritance. And that could mean quite a long time. It could be brief. But in general, it would be late 20s or 30s, just like today. Let's take a look at this, what I call the decisive decade, that is the 20s. For some young people, this is a period of exploration. They try jobs. They try on relationships. They try to live in various cities. And they build up their resume and discover who they are. And then there is a larger group of young people who do not graduate from college, who are aimless during their 20s, and who will eventually fall into a job that may or may not reflect their interests, and many too many of them will experience an unplanned pregnancy or abuse substances or experience a mental health issue or become involved with our criminal justice system. And so we have two paths through this decade, and what determines which path kids will follow? Well, the answer is parents will determine that. Parents who can provide both the financial resources and the guidance, support.
Basement.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
That will make all the difference in the world whether kids will successfully navigate this incredibly risk-filled period that's much riskier than it was in the past.
It's interesting you write about, I mentioned Henry David Thoreau, really took forever to kind of make his transition. You write about this kind of ordinary fellow, John Dane, who is this tailor. This was in the, I think this was in the 18th century, moves yes. from one job to another, one city to another. Mark Twain did it. And women, you tell us a story about Esther Edwards Burr, which kind of illustrates this life of unpredictability and uncertainty in that stage. Do you want to say a little bit more about that?
Absolutely. Let's take Mark Twain as an example. His books idolize childhood, but his childhood ended pretty briefly. Three of his siblings died, and his father died before he was 12. He witnessed at least three murders, including seeing a slave beaten to death while he was still a child. In other words, he may have presented a kind of sentimentalized, romantic depiction of childhood that we all wish we could give our own children, but his childhood was not like that. So at the age of 12, after his father dies, he has to support himself. And so he lives in New York City, in Washington, D.C., St. Louis, and Keokuk, Iowa, all before the age of 18. I mean, I can't at least, imagine my own kids doing anything like that. I mean, what independence, what self-confidence that would require, I'm not sure I would have it today in my own life, let alone when I was his age. And that was the kind of world young people had to maneuver. This world of utter unpredictability. We have given our kids much more structure and much more support, especially through their teen years. And one of our concerns as a society is what happens in the 20s when we take away that support structure and we haven't yet imposed a new support structure, that is family life. For a lot of kids, this means they're navigating without a life raft. And for many, many kids, they don't navigate this very successfully.
I wanted to come back to that, the idea of achieving intimacy. This is one of those defining features of adulthood you write about. And you say in the book that over the last 50 years or so, more and more adults have come to see their relationships, their friendships, as that deepest source of their happiness, the deepest source of their satisfaction. Talk a little bit about that. Is that a new thing, a new phenomenon?
If one looks to the past, one would be amazed by how intimate many relationships were, how close they were. Abraham Lincoln shared a house, I mean, technically actually shared a bed with a man named Joshua Speed, who was his closest confidant through life and who provided advice and guidance and an opportunity to vent and support. It's our view of best friend forever in our world today. But what's changed, I think, is the following. It used to be that intimate relationships were diffused among a wide variety of individuals, especially one's extended family. And today, our intimacy is much more concentrated, often on a single individual. And I would just like to suggest very tentatively that the other way was probably better. That it's hard for any single individual to meet all of our needs, and that it's probably better to have a lot of friends and a lot of close relatives to sort of share the burdens of life with. We need the key to happiness, most social science research suggests, is not your income, not your professional success, not the awards you achieve, but the strength of the social network that you forge in your life. And the broader and deeper that that network is, the better off you will be in life. And, you know, I am a strong, strong advocate for a deep, intense relationship with one person, but it needs to be supported by strong, intense friendships with other people, too.
Here's the sad irony that you point out in the book, that contemporary society makes friendships more necessary but less sustainable. So I wanted to ask you about that, because there's that big question of what happens to friendships, what happens to intimacy, you know, in the era of electronic communication. And you ask, can social media, you know, can Facebook or any of the other you know, dimensions of social media, can that replace face-to-face encounters? And you sound doubtful.
Yeah, I am doubtful. But I would say this. The essence of friendship is face-to-face conversation. And there really is no real substitute for that. Letters and emails can never have the nuance or expansiveness that a conversation can have. But what electronic media can do is it can keep those friendships alive. And when you need them, and we all do, we will all go through experiences that require us to turn to others for support. And then Facebook and Twitter and all the other social networking tools will have maintained those relationships so one can turn to those people for real. And, you know, can friends replace family? I'm doubtful. But are friends necessary to help sustain families and to sustain us through all of life's vicissitudes? Absolutely.
Stephen Mintz is with us. His book is called The Prime of Life, A History of Modern Adulthood. And we need to take another quick break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with historian Stephen Mintz. We're talking about his new book, The Prime of Life, A History of Modern Adulthood. I wanted to ask you, Stephen Mintz, about marriage. You write about marriage and choosing marriage and choosing not to get married. It's interesting. It really wasn't until after World War II that people started marrying at these young ages. I mean, before that, generally, you sort of pointed this out a little bit earlier, but generally people waited.
Right. But I would add this to that comment. It is a relatively recent phenomena that most adults will spend most of their adult lives outside of marriage. And we worry about that a lot, but it also seems to be generally the case that delayed marriage results in more stable marriages. And one of the things that it's very striking is that for those who do marry, marriages are less likely to end in divorce than they were in the 1990s or 1980s or 1970s. What's particularly of concern to me is there is a growing class divide between those who marry and remain married and those who either don't marry or marry and get divorced very quickly. Social class is becoming more and more a primary determinant shaping people's life trajectory. If you go to college and you get a college degree, it's likely you will marry and remain married. One of the most kind of shocking statistics for me is that if you take those prestigious universities, the Ivy League universities, my memory is that roughly 80% of the students come from intact two-parent families. It's probably not an accident, right? And so for large segments of our population, we're actually doing better than we were 3 or 4 decades ago. But we need to worry about others because we do know that unstable personal relationships are not a good thing for kids.
Seems like this socioeconomic dimension, this idea of class, that's a huge theme in the book. And this idea of economic equality. I mean, the more affluent you are, the more inclined you are to get married. But what does that mean culturally if there's such a divide? What are the cultural dimensions of this inequality? What does that mean for us?
Well, class is creating cleavages in the way that children are growing up. And this can have huge repercussions for the rest of their lives. We know that kids in more affluent households get much greater investments in their intellectual and educational upbringing. We know they're much more likely to go to summer camp. We know they have many more words spoken to them when they're infants. We know that there are many more books in their house. And that provides a foundation for a lot of future success. And as a society, we have to worry about the kids who aren't getting that. I'm a historian. I'm terrible at predicting the future, and I'm not a policymaker. But as a society, we can see a challenge, and we need to figure out ways to help people meet this challenge in a productive way.
You lay out three alternatives to marriage that you're saying. Single motherhood, unmarried cohabitation, and then the single life in general. Some of these are... go ahead, sorry.
None of these are new.
You're right, of course.
Kind of contrary to what people sometimes think. They have a much greater history. Now, the reasons were different.
Yeah.
That is, most single parents in the past were the products either of the premature death of a spouse or abandonment. And the single life was largely caused by great gaps in sex ratios mm-hmm. across the country. In many Western areas, not Utah, there were many more men than women. And in the Northeast, there were many more women than men. And it meant that large numbers of people could never marry. But if the causes have changed, the reality has changed somewhat less. And I think it's reassuring, at least I find it reassuring, to see that things aren't changing out of control, but things are sort of going back to what was the long-term normal mm-hmm. in American society.
Which was instability.
Yes, I'm afraid that's the case, but if they survived it, we who are much more affluent and much better educated should be able to survive it.
So because that's the – so this idea of instability then as being the norm, I guess the question that I wondered was I get that you're a historian and you're trying to put some historical perspective to what's going on today, but what sort of guidance can we really take from an historical moment if the dimensions of the issue are so different today? We know economic equality is distinctive to this time. Or maybe not. I mean,
okay, takeaway number one.
Okay.
Most of our problems are self-inflicted. In the past, most of the problems adults face were not self-inflicted. They were disease. They were the products of economic booms and busts and the like. But most of the problems you and I face, I'm afraid, we decided to have them. We decided how many hours to devote to work. We decided whether to move or not move in terms of work. You and I decide, more or less, how much we're going to privilege our personal relationships and how much we're going to privilege our work lives. You and I decide, more or less, not each of us, whether we're going to remain married or we're going to get divorced. You and I decide how we're going to raise our children. And we can make those decisions totally individualistically in terms of our best interest, define me.
Yeah.
Or we can define them in some other way and set our priorities differently. That's our choice. People in the past did not have that choice. We do. And we should accept the burden of maturity and make self-conscious choices. To me, it's a kind of simple takeaway, but I don't think it's a simple-minded takeaway. Yeah. Another takeaway that I have is the importance of resilience, the importance of optimism, the importance of seeing ourselves as the authors of our own lives. We are not passive victims. We are not just dust balls being blown around by wind. We control our own destiny. And if we think that way, if we think like an adult, in other words, we can navigate all of life's difficulties without feeling sorry for ourselves, which doesn't do any good to anyone.
Right. You know, you illustrate this point really well in the end of the book, where you write about this Henry James short story, where the character is looking back on his life and wishing that he had a second life to apply all the lessons he had learned from that first one. But he says, it's too late, you know, I'm done for. But then you tell this story about from the writer of Joyce Carol Oates, who has a different take on that story. The idea that, in fact, no, it's not too late. When you get into adulthood, you don't have to think, "Oh, I've wasted it." That there's time, and that seems like that modern take, that modern spin on this idea of being adult. That seems like the thing that you're looking for, that positive sort of embrace adulthood kind of perspective.
What's unique about our time, what is the great triumph of our time, I am convinced, is that we now have the power to reinvent our lives at any age. We need to do it responsibly, I'm convinced, but I think we now don't view our lives as being in a rut that we can't get out of under any circumstances. Instead, we feel free to redefine the direction of our lives, to find new meaning at any age. I don't think anybody who's over the age of 40 feels like they're over the hill. We reject that notion. We instead see ourselves as, whether it's 50 is the new 30 or 60 is the new 50, we see ourselves as freer than ever before to chart a life that gives us and those we're connected to meaning and fulfillment
Let me ask you this finally. You've taken on the history of the family, the American family. You've taken on the history of childhood. You've taken on the history now of adulthood. But you say in the book that you're thinking actually doing a part two of this history of modern adulthood. So what's number four? Have you started working it out?
Well, I've been thinking quite a bit of it. It's the period from retirement on.
Yeah.
And there's been a lot of work on aging. And I don't want to duplicate the work that others have done. If you're going to write a book, you need to do your book, not somebody else's book. And so I really need to think through how we can understand aging not as a story of decline, not as a story of increasing physical debilities, but a time of meaning. We live in a society, I think very unfortunately, that is extremely age segregated. That is, teens don't have much to do with people in their 20s, let alone people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, or 60s. And our elders don't have much to do with anybody much younger than them, except for their grandchildren and their own children. I view this as awful. And if I were king, it would be something that would be overcome. But the question then is, how can, as we age, we continue to find connections across these age barriers? How can we find meaning and not give in to a sense that we're declining as we age?
Stephen Mintz, his new book is The Prime of Life, A History of Modern Adulthood. Professor, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you very much for speaking with me.
Radio West, a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.